Take them from the front. I'm kidding. But this is good. I will be there, and many of the people in this room will be there as well. So the OA birthday is a good thing. I'm going to leave the OABirthday.com. If you want information, registration, go to OABirthday.com. Okay? So that's good. And it'll be, as I said, the LAX Hilton, which is, if I had a brain, I would have stayed there last night. If I had a brain, if I had a hammer. I hammer in the morning, I hammer in the evening. Okay. Bill Wilson was born on November the 26th, 1895. He was born in East Dorset, Vermont, which is where I was last week. John, yes, we were at the Boston World Convention, the 1st to the 4th of September, and we took a little side trip to East Dorset, Vermont, which is in the middle of literally nowhere. It's amazing, a little tiny place. We went to East Dorset, Vermont, and we went to his birthplace, and we saw his grave, and I left my 17-year chip on his headstone, which was the very moving thing. He was born in November of 1895. He had a younger sister, Dorothy, a couple years younger than him, and she is going to play into the story of the tapestry of why we're here today as well. Bill Wilson was born to a raging alcoholic named Gilman Wilson. Emily was his mother, and Gilman was his father. We saw their graves as well. And Gilman was an alcoholic of the low bottom variety. And Bill's mother divorced Bill's father when Bill was in 1906, when Bill was just 10 years old. He was born in 95. He wasn't quite 11 yet. And Dorothy and Bill were raised by their maternal grandparents, the Griffiths, in East Dorset, Vermont. Bill was a very determined child. He felt he had to work five times as hard to be half as good. Divorce had a tremendous stigma in those days. It still really does. I'm divorced, and there's like a stigma that I have in my own head sometimes. That, like, really? Because I can't even believe sometimes that it happened, but it did. And he read in a book that only an Aborigine could fashion a boomerang that would actually come back to you once it was thrown. And he worked tirelessly to fashion a boomerang that would come back. And it did. It almost killed his grandfather. It was coming back, and Grandpa Griffith almost walked right into the damn thing. And that boomerang is on his desk in his bedroom today. If you go visit there, you'll see it. Bill was a very determined child. He found a baseball glove up in Grandpa's attic, and he became the starting shortstop and co-captain of his school's baseball team. He was also very determined when he found a violin up in the attic, and he became co-first chair of his school's orchestra. Bill also suffered from depression his entire life. When Bill Wilson was 17 years old, the love of his life was Bertha Bamford, and Bertha was going to New York City to have what was told to Bill was a routine medical procedure, and she died. And Bill fell in at age 17 to one of his deep, dark, debilitating depressions. He also suffered from panic attacks his entire life. Bill felt very strongly that he was not as good as other people. Bill's father moved out to Western Canada to work in the lumber, granite, and marble yards out there. East Dorset, Vermont is rich in marble and granite and lumber, as we saw. And many of our nation's landmarks, many of our nation's important buildings are adorned with cornerstones that come from the beautiful white marble of Vermont. Bill's paternal grandfather was also an alcoholic, and while walking on Mount Elias in Vermont, he had a sudden and profound spiritual experience and never found it necessary to drink ever again in his life. Bill Wilson was a very tall, lanky guy, and he, as I said, he felt less than. He married Lois on the 24th of January, 1918, while he was being shipped off for World War I. Now, we don't know why God chose Bill, but Bill, in my opinion, did not write this book. It's just my opinion. You can have your opinion. This is my opinion. Bill had 3.5 years of sobriety when the book was written. Bill was 43 years and a half years old when this book was written. I'm 62 with 17 years of abstinence. I'm lucky I can put together a half-coherent text message. This book, in my hands, this blue book called Alcoholics Anonymous, has restored more drunks back to society, has restored more gamblers back to society, more compulsive overeaters back to society, more addicts of all varieties back to society than all other known methods combined. Nothing compares to the recovery rate of people using this book. Nothing. Page 1. War fever ran high in the New England town to which new young officers from Plattsburgh were assigned. Plattsburgh is in upstate New York. Excuse me. And we were flattered when the first citizens took us to their homes, making us feel heroic. Here was love, applause, war. Moments sublime with intervals hilarious. I was part of life at last, and in the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor. I forgot the strong warnings and prejudice of my people concerning drink. In time, we sailed for over there. Over there denotes World War I. I was very lonely and again turned to alcohol. We landed in England. I visited Winchester Cathedral. Much moved, I wandered outside. My attention was caught by a doggerel on an old tombstone. Here lies a Hampshire grenadier who caught his death drinking cold small beer. A good soldier is ne'er forgot whether he dieth by musket or by pot. Now let's clear something up here. He's not talking about somebody who died smoking marijuana. He is looking at a tombstone, knowing his family history, knowing that he is having problems with alcohol. And by the way, Bill's story is divided into two distinct sections. The first 8 pages are about Bill's plunge into alcoholism, and the second 8 pages is how a recovery was affected therefrom. But he is looking at a tombstone of a soldier in England who died drinking too much beer. In England, they drank beer in pots in those days, quart pots and pint pots. And it was considered extremely bad manners to sit and consume alcohol. They stood and they consumed alcohol while standing. And there was a bar in the saloon that they could lean against. And that's where the name bar comes from. And they had pint pots and quart pots. And when they get a little unruly, the barkeeper would say, "Hey, watch your pints and quarts back there." And as that expression came to the colonies in the early 1700s, late 1600s, it became Americanized into what we know as watch your P's and Q's. And that's where that comes into our language today. So we give you everything here at the Big Book Ministry. We are a full service. We are a full service mini retreat. Ominous warning, which I failed to heed. 22 and a veteran of foreign wars, I went home at last. I fancied myself a leader, for had not the men of my battery given me a special token of appreciation, my talent for leadership, I imagine, would place me at the head of vast enterprises, which I would manage with the utmost assurance. I took a night law course and obtained employment as investigator for a surety company. The drive for success was on. I proved to the world I was important. Can't relate to that, huh? My work took me about Wall Street, and little by little, I became interested in the market. Many people lost money, but some became very rich. Why not I? I studied economics and business as well as law. Potential alcoholic that I was, I nearly failed my law course at one of the finals. I was too drunk to think or write. Though my drinking was not yet continuous, it disturbed my wife. Let me stop right there. He failed his law course. What's important for me to remember there is that this illness destroyed, pulverized every dream I ever dreamed. The saddest words of tongue or pen are these few words, "It might have been." Who would I be today had I not had this illness? What could I have done? Where could I have gone? Would I be in the business that I'm in? I hope not. Would I have done the things I did? Probably not. Because my judgment was clouded. My brain was askew. My whole judgment, my whole decision-making process was unreliable. And it was just not God-directed. It was fear-directed and anger-driven. Every dream I dreamed, I would reach for something and the food would just slap my hand down. So I knew inherently that none of my dreams were going to come true. And as I've said before, I begged for death. I wanted to die. What was the point of living? I wasn't happy eating and I wasn't happy not eating. I couldn't live eating and I couldn't live not eating. So let's take a look here at what he says here. He says, though my drinking was not yet continuous, it disturbed my wife. We had long talks when I would still her forebodings by telling her that men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk, that the most majestic constructions of philosophic thought were so derived. What is the first victim of compulsive behavior?
The truth.
The truth. Thank you. The truth. The first thing to go out the window when this illness is practiced is any modicum of honesty. This illness will destroy honesty. Okay. By the time I had completed the course, I knew the law was not for me. The inviting maelstrom of Wall Street had me in its grip. Business and financial leaders were my heroes. Out of this alloy of drink and speculation, I commenced to forge the weapon that one day would turn in its flight like a boomerang and all but cut me to ribbons. Living modestly, my wife and I saved $1,000. Now, there's probably not too many people in this room that don't have a credit card or debit card worth $1,000. I'm not going to make you put up your hand if you don't, but $1,000 in the 1920s was this valuable. In Chicago, you could buy a brand new house for about $1,800. Not a schlock house. I'm talking about nice house, backyard, white picket fence, 2.5 kids for $1,800. The dog is optional. You could buy a brand new Ford car for $495. A Dodge would be about $500. You could get two new cars for $1,000. Get two new cars, that's quite a bit of money, right? The reason that I tell you this is to put this into perspective, that the numbers we're going to be throwing out here are important to note. Okay? It went into certain securities, then cheap and rather unpopular. I rightly imagine they would someday have a great rise. I failed to persuade my broker friends to send me out looking over factories and management, but my wife and I decided to go anyway. I had developed a theory that most people lost money in stocks through ignorance of markets. I discovered many more reasons later on. Now, Bill Wilson is not really a stockbroker. He is self-described as a stockbroker. He's really not. What he is a New York City stock speculator. And he made his living selling his opinion to other investors that based on what he thought would the market would go, they would invest their money on his expertise and they would cut him in on the profit. Today we would call him a day trader slash investment consultant. And he is making money. But what would happen in the 1920s, we saw some of this in the pre-2006-2007 crash. We saw that housing was going up and up and up and up. We saw the stock market. Literally, you could take a chimpanzee, put him in the chair, and tell the chimp to throw a dart at the board. You hit a stock with the dart, invest in that stock on about a 10% margin, and you'd probably make money. But Bill was smart enough to know that what comes up must come down. And there's going to be an end to this. And there's going to be a day of reckoning to all this. And they said to him, oh, get out of here, Wilson, for God's sake. I think you're making too much damn money and it's going to your head. And he says, no, I'm serious. We need this information. Well, he was cunning, baffling, and powerful too. And he takes poor Lois and he puts her in the sidecar of a motorcycle. And there's pictures of this you can see online. He shoves her in the sidecar of a motorcycle. And what did he know how to do? He knew how to drink in a bar. And he'd wait in the bar at 5 o'clock. And these guys would come in and he'd get in for, because he knew how to talk. Bill was a talker. So he knew how to get information from these guys and these gals on what was going on at their companies. And he would write this information down, send it back to his friends in New York, and they're looking at this information and they're saying, you know what? I really think this is good. You've done some good things here. Let's see where he goes. Wife and I decided to go anyway. I had developed a theory that most people lost money in stocks through ignorance of markets. I discovered many more reasons later on. We gave up our positions and off we roared on a motorcycle. The sidecar stuffed with tents, blankets, a change of clothes, 3 huge volumes of a financial reference service. Our friends thought a lunacy commission should be appointed. Perhaps they were right. I had had some success in speculation, so we had a little money. We once worked on a farm for a month to avoid drawing on our small capital. That was the last honest manual labor on my part for many a day. We covered the whole eastern United States in a year. At the end of it, my reports to Wall Street procured me a position there in the use of a large expense account. The exercise of an option brought in more money, leaving us with a profit of several thousand dollars for that year. He's making surgeon money now. The average salary probably in those days was about $20-$30 a week. Remember I told you before that Dr. Silkworth, not Street Sweeper Silkworth, not Bus Driver Silkworth, not that there's anything wrong with that, but Dr. Silkworth went to work at the town's hospital in 1929 for $35 a week. He's making surgeon money now, Bill Wilson is. For the next few years, fortune through money and applause my way, I had arrived. Whoa. Now, you guys are Los Angeles? Is that how you say that? Angelinos. You guys see them coming in here by the truckload every day. The actresses, the actors, the directors, the writers, the whatever, they're coming in here every day. And most of them will go home and not have been, they will not win the Academy Award. It's just life. It's not because of, I said so, it's just life. Most of them will go home without ever achieving that dream. And some of them will become Californians, and some of them will go back to God knows where, but whatever. He is in New York City, man. He is riding high. Here's the kid from East Dorset, Vermont, and he says, I had arrived. Let's see where we go from there. My judgment and ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions. Now, let's take a look at that. I don't want to get too pedantic, but it's worth looking at. Can you just imagine, that whatever it is you do for a living, whether you're a housewife or you're an airplane pilot or you stand on your head for a living, or whatever it is you do, you become the standard by which others are judged. He had arrived. He was Bill Wilson. People are looking at his opinion and investing millions. A couple of people? No. Many. Many. Can you just imagine what that would do for your ego? Can you just imagine what that would do for your ego knowing that Joe Blow and Jeff M. and Joe Gabuzzi and John Kay invested millions of dollars based on your opinion, and this is what he's living with, and he's drinking, and it's working for him, and he's going well. Now, what happens from here? The great boom of the late 20s, and was seething and swelling. Drink was taking an important and exhilarating part in my life. There was loud talk in the jazz places uptown. Everyone spent in thousands, chattered in millions. Scoffers could scoff and be damned. I made a host of fair-weather friends. Make note of that. We're going to come back to that. I made a host of fair-weather friends. These people wanted to be around him, as in the same thing as if through that door right now became a movie star, a sports star, a public figure. You know, you just want to be with them. You want to rub elbows with them. You want to think they're your buddy, your friend, your pal, because that's very ego-gratifying, and people are doing that to him. Now, let's see where he goes in just two sentences. My drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. The remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf. Remonstrances are protestations. Remonstrances are protestations. People are getting on him. Bill, you're drinking too much. Bill, you're getting drunk. Bill, you're really ruining everything. Bill, what are you doing? Bill, what's going on here? And he says, screw you. I need you like I need strep throat. And he becomes a lone wolf. And how many times was the dream right in front of us? How many times was the dream right there and we kept eating because we didn't know how to stop? Everything I ever wanted was right there. All I ever wanted to be was thin. All I ever wanted to do was eat. All I ever wanted to be was thin. All I ever wanted to do was eat. There were many unhappy scenes in our sumptuous apartment. There had been no real infidelity, for loyalty to my wife, helped at times by extreme drunkenness, kept me out of those scrapes. Now, we have a book in Al-Anon called As Lois Remembers, and we have a book in AA called As Bill Sees It, and this is one of the parts where they're not exactly the same. In 1929... Bill was very human. He did a lot of very human things. And this is one of the things that he did. In 1929, I contracted golf fever. We went at once to the country, my wife to applaud, while I started out to overtake Walter Hagen. Liquor caught up with me much faster than I came up behind Walter. I began to be jittery in the morning. Golf permitted drinking every day and every night. It was fun to carom around the exclusive course which had inspired such awe in me as a lad. I acquired the impeccable coat of tan one sees upon the well-to-do. The local banker watched me whirl fat checks in and out of his till with amused skepticism. Abruptly, in October 1929. Remember I told you we'd come back to this? Abruptly in October 1929, hell broke loose on the New York Stock Exchange. After one of those days of inferno, I wobbled from a hotel bar to a brokerage office. It was 8 o'clock, 5 hours after the market closed. The ticker still clattered. I was staring at an inch of tape which bore the inscription XYZ32. It had been 52 that morning. I was finished, and so were many friends. The papers reported men jumping to death from the towers of high finance. That disgusted me. We'll come back to that. That disgusted me. I would not jump. I went back to the bar. Why? Because he saw these guys jumping off the building. Now, the tallest building in Chicago at that time was the Prudential Building, which is 32 stories. And now it looks like one of the gift shops in the Hancock Building, which is 103 stories. But the Prudential Building, these guys would go up there and jump. Why? Because their God was dead. Their God was money. Their God was the stock market. Their God was the investments. And the investments was dead, and the money was dead, and the stocks were dead. And everything they had worked toward, everything they had wanted in their life had been destroyed by this Great Depression. You know, we talked a few years ago, now it's much better, but we talked a few years ago, there was 10 and 15% unemployment. In those days, it was 35 and 40% unemployment. Among minority workers, the unemployment was 75, 80, and 90%. So you talk about soup kitchens. You talk about people standing in line to get a loaf of bread. You talk about the Depression, and you talk about something which most human beings cannot even comprehend. The unemployment was 35, 40%. And again, with minorities, it was closer to 75 and 80% unemployment. So you're talking about absolute deprivation in this country. And when the United States catches cold, the rest of the world gets pneumonia. It was horrible all over the globe. There was no part that was untouched. So he sees these guys jump. What does he do? He goes back to the bar. Without knowing it, he knows that he can get relief from these emotions through liquor. Why? Because of what we talked about. Because the liquor will do something for him that it doesn't do for most people. It will give him an instant sense of ease and comfort. Instantly put him right back on track. Okay. As I drank, oh wait, I skipped a sentence here. I went back to the bar. My friends, thank you, had dropped several million since 10 o'clock. So what? Tomorrow was another day. As I drank, the old fierce determination to win came back. And that's the effect of the liquor. It gives them that sense of ease and comfort. Remember that food does something for me, not to me, for me, that it doesn't do for normal, everyday human beings. It gives me a sense of ease and comfort that comes instantly from eating it. Next morning, I telephoned a friend in Montreal. That would be his friend, Dick Johnson. He had plenty of money left and thought I had better go to Canada. By the following spring, we were living in our accustomed style. I felt like Napoleon returning from Elba. No St. Helena for me. St. Helena is where Napoleon was banished to, where he couldn't come back. That was the end for him. And Elba was a place, an island that he was banished to, where he did come back and reconquer his lost territories. He showed them. He thought this was Elba, not St. Helena. But drinking caught up with me again, and my generous friend had to let me go. This time, we stayed broke. Now, before we read the next sentence, I want to put into historical context what's going on here. Lois was a Burnham. Lois was a Burnham, and her father was Dr. Burnham. Dr. Burnham hated Bill's guts. Dr. Burnham thought Bill was the scum of the earth. Lois had ectopic pregnancies. And in an ectopic pregnancy, she calls her dad and says, "Daddy, I'm bleeding. I can't stop the bleeding. You've got to come over here." He comes over there. It's early evening. It's about 4 p.m. He comes over there. This is when doctors made house calls. He comes over there, and he takes a look at his daughter, and he says, "Oh, my God, we've got to get you to the hospital. You're going to bleed out. You're hemorrhaging." They go to the hospital. They leave a note on the table. "We are at Roosevelt Hospital. Come meet us immediately. Lois is sick." The next morning, in comes Yutz, stinking to high hell, filthy dirty. He looked like he had been in a fight. He comes in unshaven, unclean, unwashed, filthy, dirty clothes. He smells like a combination of a brewery and vomit and BO. And he comes in there, and Dr. Burnham has a pertinent question. "Where were you?" I don't think this thing's working. "Where were you?" This thing definitely has a life of... Either that or you're screwing with me, buddy. Okay. So now, where were you? Well, you didn't have to ask him where he was. He was drunk. Where do you think he was? He was out drinking. He was bombed. He gets the note. He goes over to the hospital the next morning, and Lois was furious, and her father never really forgave Bill. He didn't want his daughter to marry Bill. They were wealthy. They had a home in Manchester, Vermont, where wealthy people have summer homes. And that's how he knew Lois. But Lois was a couple of years older than him. And Bill didn't come from a very prestigious family, as we've talked about. But the Burnhams were very unimpressed with Bill. They thought that their daughter could do a lot better. And this just made a bad situation worse. And the reason that I tell you this is because when we read the next sentence, we went to live with my wife's parents. Now, here's the Prince of Wall Street that was flaunting his success in Dr. Burnham's face. Oh, yeah, you thought I'd be a big loser, huh, Doc? Look at your daughter now. She's living in the lap of luxury here. Look at this Park Avenue apartment. Well, we know what happened with that, right? Now they're going to live with these people. Can you just imagine what Bill is going through emotionally? I found a job. He tells his wife, tells them, I've got a job. But then what happened? Lost it as a result of a brawl with a taxi driver. Mercifully, no one could guess that I was to have no real employment for 5 years or hardly draw a sober breath. My wife began to work in a department store, coming home exhausted to find me drunk. I became an unwelcome hanger-on at brokerage places. So she says to him in the morning, she's going to work. She makes $19 a week salary plus commission. She's making an average of about $25, $26, $27 a week. She's working 12 to 15 hours on her feet in high heels at a department store, Lohmann's department store in New York. And she's working at the cosmetic counter. And she's asking him as she leaves in the morning, Yutz, can you please take a shower, take a bath, shave, put on some clean clothes. I left you clean clothes in your bedroom, in our bedroom. Please take the breakfast dishes, and you don't have to wash them, just put them in the sink. So 15 hours later, she comes home. He stinks even worse. No shave, no shower, no clean clothes, and the breakfast dishes are still on the table. And the reason I paint that picture for you is you have to know the environment in which he is living. His only respite is through the liquor. His only place of sanity or place of peace is when he's absolutely blotto drunk, because he hates his life, he hates everything that's happened to him, and he can scarcely believe that somebody as smart as him, I know none of us can relate to this, somebody that's as smart as him and as wonderful as him is in this position today. And he blames who? Blames God, blames himself, blames Lois, blames the Burnhams. Top of page 5. Liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. One of these days I'll come back to Los Angeles, and I'd like to do a Friday night, all day Saturday, and Sunday morning retreat. And I'll do it just on that frickin' sentence. Liquor ceased to be a luxury, and it became a necessity. We could write a book just on that sentence right there. Bathtub gin. This is the time, this is the days of prohibition. This isn't the days when bootleggers were around. 2 bottles a day, often 3, got to be routine. Sometimes a small deal would net a few $100s, and I would pay my bills at the bars and delicatessens. This went on endlessly, and I began to waken very early in the morning, shaking violently. Now, I lived in Eugene, Oregon for 9 years. I went out there for business, made a lot of money. But there is no OA in Eugene, Oregon. There's no such thing. It doesn't exist. I tried to get meetings started, and I ended up just looking at my daughter, who was like, you know, in diapers, and my wife, and they would come to the meetings, and it would be me and them. I couldn't get anything going there. So I had to go to AA or die. And you'd see these guys coming in, and you talk about a drinking problem. Their hands were shaking so violently that they were lucky if they were drinking coffee that they could even put it in their mouth and not pour it on the person behind them, because they're shaking so violently. Now, the danger of the DTs isn't just the shaking, but the heart is also a muscle. And if it becomes affected by this, that's not a good situation. The heart is also a muscle. A tumbler full of gin would be... Let's try reading in English. Okay. A tumbler full of gin followed by half a dozen bottles of beer, thank you, would be required. The key word there is required. Make sure it's highlighted in your brain. Required if I were to eat any breakfast. Nevertheless, I thought I could control the situation. There were periods of sobriety which renewed my wife's hope. In other words, what's he doing there? He's going on what we would know as a diet. Oh, this is a good group. I'll come back here anytime. This is a good group. A diet. He's going on a diet. He sees that his drinking is getting out of control, and so what he does is he goes on a diet. But because he nor Lois know anything about alcoholism, they figure that as long as he's got the awareness and as long as he's taking action, that his problem is now solved, which of course, well, we'll let the book tell you. Gradually things got better. Nope. Gradually things got worse. My house was taken over by the mortgage holder. My mother-in-law died. My wife and father-in-law became ill. Then I got a promising business opportunity. Stocks were at a low point of 1932, and I had somehow formed a group to buy. I was to share generously in the profits. Then I went on a prodigious bender, and the chance vanished. This is a story within the story. Takes place in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. I was lucky enough to do a big book study in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, a number of years ago. Mount Laurel is right by Cherry Hill, and I was up there freezing my potatoes off. And we actually had dinner on Saturday night in Cherry Hill, okay? And these people from Cherry Hill really liked Bill and the work that he had done, so they approached him. But they were trepidatious because they also knew of his drinking. And to know Bill is to know that he's a drunk. And they approached him on one of his diets and said, "Can you put this together for us?" And he said, "Yes, I can." And they met in a hotel room in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And somebody brought a bottle of moonshine whiskey along. And they started passing it around. And it went around the first time. Bill didn't take any. And then it went around again, and somebody nudged Bill and said, "Hey, I made this myself. It's called Jersey Lightning. You can have one drink." So Bill, because of the buildup of emotions and because he wanted what the liquor would do for him, because he was in a business meeting, what do you think was building up? Human emotions. And what do you think he wanted a relief from? The pain of these human emotions. He takes a drink in search of the effect, which is that sense of ease and comfort. So he takes the drink, and what happens then is he gets the relief, but it also triggers the physical allergy, and he can't come out of that hotel room for 3 more days, and the chance vanished. I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way, and I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective, seeing near being just that, renewing my resolve, going back on my diet, I tried again. Some time passed, and confidence began to be replaced by cocksureness. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. One day I walked into a cafe to telephone. In no time I was beating on the bar, asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk then, and I did. He walks into a cafe to make a telephone call. The funeral home didn't have a phone. The transmission shop didn't have a phone. The barber shop didn't have a phone. The clothing store didn't have a phone. He has to walk into a cafe to make a telephone call because he wanted to get drunk. And he was just cooking up that excuse for Lois to say, "Well, I was just there to make a phone call and some guy bought me a drink." What caused him to take the first drink? The mental twist. What caused him to take the 20th drink? The physical allergy. If he can't drink because of the allergy, and he can't keep from drinking because of the twist of the mind, he is powerless over alcohol, and his life is unmanageable. The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity. I hardly dare cross the street lest I collapse and be run down by an early morning truck, for it was scarcely daylight. An all-night place supplied me with a dozen glasses of ale. My writhing nerves were stilled at last. A morning paper told me the market had gone to hell again. Well, so had I. The market would recover, but I wouldn't. That was a hard thought. Should I kill myself? No, not now. Then a mental fog settled down. Gin would fix that. Two bottles and oblivion. Two bottles of gin. Two bottles of gin. Now he's looking at these guys and he's thinking of killing himself too. He's cornered. There is no relief. He can't get drunk and get relief, and he can't get sober and get relief. He's trying to get sober. He's fighting like a fish on the line, but the fisherman, the alcoholism, is playing him, and he can't get drunk and live, and he can't get sober and live. There's nothing in it for him whatsoever, and he now is thinking about killing himself too. And that's why I had you make note of it. When he looked down his nose at the people that wanted to commit or did commit suicide, now he's thinking about it too, and so did I. I contemplated it very seriously. I wanted to commit suicide because I saw no purpose to life. If there was no respite in food and no respite in not eating food, what is the point? The mind and body are marvelous mechanisms for mind endured this agony 2 more years. Unbelievable pain and torture in the life of a compulsive overeater. I couldn't sleep in a bed for years because I couldn't lay flat and breathe. The edema in my lower extremities was so profuse that I could hardly get up from a chair without excruciating pain. The pus used to run out the back of my legs. I had no ankles for years. I had cankles. I couldn't walk. I couldn't sit without falling asleep. I pissed in my pants. I crapped in my pants. I farted constantly. I smelled like a zoo. I looked like a sideshow. I didn't wear underwear because I had towels shoved between layers of flab so that the skin wouldn't rub together, causing contact dermatitis, which is when the skin rubs together and it becomes weeping and open and red and angry, and it's extremely painful. Feels like you're on fire and there's no relief from it at all whatsoever. The only relief is in eating Chips Ahoy by the bag. Why I didn't kill myself, how I didn't kill myself, I don't know. But I was effectively dead. God gave me this life. What I do with it is my gift back. That's why it's called the present moment. It's a present. And what I was doing was giving God the finger and saying, I don't want this life that you gave me. I want to give it back. I don't want to fulfill my destiny. On the top of page 77 in the big book, it tells me why I was born, where it says, our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. That is an Oxford Group ideal. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. In what way could I be of maximum service except as a cautionary tale? Today, I go home to Chicago, and there are still people that say, you can't be Harlan Grabowski. He died a number of years ago. Who are you really? I've had to pull my driver's license out and show people that I am indeed him, because they can't believe that I'm not dead. The mind and body are marvelous mechanisms for mine enduring this agony 2 more years. Sometimes I stole from my wife's slender purse when the morning terror and madness were on me. Excuse me. Again, I swayed dizzily before an open window or the medicine cabinet where there was poison, cursing myself for a weekend. There were flights from city to country and back as my wife and I sought escape. Then came the night when the physical and mental torture were so hellish that I feared I would burst through my window sash and all. Somehow I managed to drag my mattress to a lower floor, lest I suddenly leap. A doctor came with a heavy sedative. Next day found me drinking both gin and sedative. This combination soon landed me on the rocks. People feared for my sanity. So did I. I could eat little or nothing when drinking, and I was 40 pounds underweight. Is his being 40 pounds underweight any different from some of us who've been overweight or underweight? Absolutely not. It's exactly the same thing. It's exactly the same thing. He had alcoholic gastritis. And the pain of eating was too great. He couldn't do it. If there was no olives in martinis, some of these guys would starve to death. Because they occasionally, and I learned this through being in Eugene, occasionally they'll eat a bologna sandwich only because they know you're supposed to eat something. But the thought of food is so revolting to them that they can't, because it just hurts too much to eat. And there are anorexics and bulimics in this room that absolutely can relate. They absolutely can relate because they're just so afraid of that. They're afraid of eating. And a lot of them die. A lot of them die, you know, at 90, 80, 90, 100. Okay. It relieved me somewhat to learn that an alcoholic... Oh, wait. Where am I?
My brother.
Oh, my brother. Okay, wait. This is important. Thanks for reminding me, Ellie. Oh, yeah, I got to get up for this part because this is important now. Now, we're going to start to see, if I don't fall down, we're going to start to see God's hand. We're going to start to see the constellations of recovery begin to permeate the dark, freezing cave of alcoholism. We're going to see the hand of God. Now, we've already told you that Bill's mother, by this time, was an osteopathic physician living in Boston. And I told you that Dorothy Wilson was going to marry somebody who was going to play in this tapestry, and she married Dr. Leonard Strong. And if I had the time, I would tell you there's another place where Dr. Leonard Strong plays in, and that's in, he is going to connect Clarence Snyder to Dr. Bob, and Clarence is going to accelerate the split from the Oxford Group movement. But I don't have the time to go into that today because it's minute. Well, Dr. Strong liked Bill. He was one of those, they're coming to get me. Because Dr. Strong liked Bill. He was one of the few people who really liked him. And also Bill's mother. Now, let's take a look at the chapter, and let's take a look at all the miracles that are about to happen so that we could be sitting here today and be alive and have this book and have our fellowship of Overeaters Anonymous. Let's take a look at where this begins, because we're now going to the very beginning, before the beginning of the beginning. My brother-in-law is a physician. I love saying that. Okay. My brother-in-law is a physician, and through his kindness and that of my mother, I was placed in a nationally known hospital for the mental and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics. Now, this is 1933, and of all the hospitals that Bill could have been admitted to, he was admitted to the Towns Hospital in New York City. The Towns Hospital. Sounds familiar? Okay. Under the so-called Belladonna treatment, Belladonna was like Valium. It was used to fool the body into thinking it had alcohol in it. Under the so-called Belladonna treatment, my brain cleared. Hydrotherapy and mild exercise helped much. Best of all, I met a kind doctor. Now, of all the doctors on staff at the Towns Hospital, it's 1933. They're going crazy. There is no Alcoholics Anonymous at this time. So these guys are getting dumped by the dozen into these hospitals. And of all the doctors that he could have been assigned to while at the Towns, he gets assigned to Dr. William Duncan Silkworth. All right, so... best of all, I met a kind doctor who explained that though certainly selfish and foolish, I had been seriously ill, bodily, the allergy, mentally, the twist. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. If I got a chance to know each and every one of you. Some of you I know kind of, some of you I've seen through the years, some of you I know, some of you and I talk. I would be astounded at the things that you've done in your life. Getting spit on is an occupational hazard of being in the first row. I would be astounded at some of the things that you people have done in your life. But there's one thing you can't do. You can't say stop from food. And you can't, there's another thing you can't do. You can't control the amount of ice cream sandwiches you eat once you start. Because you have an allergy of the body that means once you eat an ice cream sandwich, you're going to go back to the vending machine for another one. And another one. And a 5 and a 10 and all this other stuff. And you can't stay out of that vending machine because of the twist of the mind. But when it comes to this, your will is amazingly weakened. Now I want you all to ask yourself, if you are a compulsive overeater, raise your hand. If you are ashamed of being a compulsive overeater, keep your hand up. I'm here to tell you something. Put your hands down. It's not your fault. This didn't happen to you because you zigged when you should have zagged. This didn't happen to you because you're stupid. This didn't happen to you because you're black or white or left-handed or right-handed. This didn't happen to you because you are a Jew or a Gentile or you're a whatever. It happened to you because it happened to you. You have an illness that will become the greatest gift of your life. This is the greatest way of life imaginable. You didn't do it. It wasn't done because you were stupid. It wasn't something that happened because whatever. It happened. What are you going to do about it now? Hope that you will work these miraculous steps. Bill Wilson was a smart guy. Bill Wilson had lots of character. Bill Wilson was a great stock speculator, but he was an alcoholic. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself, now I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. Goose hung high means wealth, success, prosperity. Goose is a form of prosperity. I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. But it was not. Now, 1934, he's going back into the hospital for the second time. But it was not, for the frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to the hospital, 1934. This was the finish, the curtain, it seemed to me. My weary and despairing wife was informed that it would all end with heart failure during delirium tremens, or I would develop a wet brain, perhaps within a year. She would soon have to give me over to the undertaker or the asylum. Now, Dr. Silkworth is standing there while Bill is laying in the bed after being readmitted a year after his first admission, and Dr. Silkworth is telling Lois something that he has told many, 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 many wives, that your husband is doomed. That I now understand him to be an alcoholic of the hopeless variety, and there is nothing I can do for him. He's going to get wet brain, or he's going to have to go to the insane asylum. Wet brain is really a dry brain. Alcohol sucks the moisture out of a cell. It dehydrates the cell quite effectively. And that's why when these guys wake up after a bender, they feel like they swallowed a sandbox. But the brain and the liver do not rehydrate. They don't regenerate themselves. So a wet brain is really a dry brain. And what happens is these guys literally become zucchinis. They are in the hospital. They get up. The nurse comes, changes their diaper, puts them in front of the TV set, comes back, changes their diaper, feeds them lunch, changes their diaper, puts them in front, and this is how they live. But at least Alzheimer's has the decency to kill you. At least Alzheimer's has the decency to take you out. But wet brain, these guys can hole up in the insane asylum in the hospital for decades. And the families come and cry because they don't know anybody. They don't know anything. They can't talk. They can't do anything. And it is a pathetic, pathetic situation. And this is what he is laying on Lois. And Lois is crying her eyes out because all the things that I told you about her getting mad at Bill and all the things that I told you about Dr. Burnham didn't like Bill, let me tell you this and listen to me good. She loved him. She adored him. Why in the world would she have stayed with him through all those years? What in the name of the wide, wide world of sports would have motivated her to stay with such a man over such an extended period of time? They did not need to tell me, bottom of 7. I knew and almost welcomed the idea. It was a devastating blow, excuse me, to my pride. Top of 8. I, who had thought so well of myself and my abilities and my capacity to surmount obstacles, was cornered at last. Now I was to plunge into the dark, joining the endless procession of sots who had gone on before. Sot is a drunk. I thought of my poor wife. There had been much happiness after all. What would I not give to make amends? But that was over now. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in the bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I was overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. No better description of step one has ever been written. Alcohol was my master. Trembling, I stepped from the hospital, a broken man. Fear sobered me for a bit. Then came the insidious insanity of the first drink. And on Armistice Day 1934, I was off again. Everyone became resigned to the certainty that I would have to be shut up somewhere or would stumble along to a miserable end. How dark it is before the dawn. In reality, that was the beginning of my last debauch. I was soon to be catapulted into what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. There's three dimensions we see. Health, width, height, and depth. But the fourth dimension is the dimension of the spiritual. And I like to get to this part before lunch, but I'm not going to today. And we're going to go after lunch. We're going to go into the history of step two, and we're going to be talking about step two. Near the end of that bleak note, I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness. You don't have to wait for page 83 for promises. Here they are. I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. Near the end of that bleak November, I sat drinking in my kitchen. With a certain satisfaction, I reflected there was enough gin concealed about the house to carry me through that night and the next day. My wife was at work. I wondered whether I dared hide a full bottle of gin near the head of our bed. I would need it before daylight. We're going to stop right there because I don't want to start going into the whole history of step two in the Oxford group now with 5 minutes to go. And I know not to step on lunch. I mean, I've done enough of these. I ain't doing that. So for 5 minutes, let's do Q&A. Somebody has a question. I'll let you go to lunch. Take it easy. Somebody, Elliot. No, I saw some hand. Oh, yes.
I'm right sorry, there. You said... The liver gets dehydrated, can't...
The liver and the brain don't rehydrate themselves. Liver and the brain don't rehydrate. White shirt.
Yes, you left a purpose. You said you didn't believe that the big book was written by Bill.
I believe it's written by God. I believe that it is written by God Almighty. And the reason that I believe that this book was written by God Almighty is because Bill was 43 years old, 43 and a half, when the book was written. It was written in 37, 38, came out in April of 39. Bill had... 3.5 years of sobriety. I have 17 years of abstinence. I'm 62. I'm lucky I can knock out a half-coherent text message. This book and its contents have restored more alcoholics, more drug addicts, more gamblers, more sex addicts, more bulimics, more anorexics, more whatevers, back to society and useful lives than all other methods combined. Another one. Yeah.
We're not powerless, we're helpless.
Okay. You can reach out. You can say, look, I'm swinging from the chandeliers, I need to get a couple of days, and then we're going to start working the steps. You are powerless, you are not helpless. One more and then I'll let you go to lunch. Yes?
When you came to OA in the 70s, was there a food plan that you followed?
There was a food plan that I followed. However, I came in the days of gray sheet lunacy. You had the HOW groups coming in through Evanston, Illinois with gray sheets. Then you had the food roomies. I don't like to use the word Nazis for this because to me, Nazi is a whole other thing. But I don't like to use that word, but and that's okay when somebody else says, that's fine. There were the food extremists, if you will, that if you ate, if you accidentally swallowed a mosquito, if you were driving down the street and swallow a bug, you might as well just jump out the window. It was over, man. You were done. I came in through more sane things where we would be a little more thing. But eventually food plans pare down as you age. I'm 62. I can't eat the way I did 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. If I eat that, I gain weight and lose amounts. So as you age, unfortunately, you have to cut your food. And that, you know, that's something that makes this a lot tougher than AA. There's a lot more accountability in OA than there is in any other 12-step program in the world. No 12-step program in the world has as much accountability as Overeaters Anonymous because the accountability does not change. Now, Clancy Imeslin is the senior person in AA in the world, right? Here comes Joe Blow. He's in his first day of sobriety. They're on the same alcohol plan. They just don't drink alcohol. John has his food plan. I have my food plan. Ellie has her food plan. What works for me won't work for you. You might have hypoglycemia. You might be whatever. So there's a lot more accountability in here. And that's why, I'll turn the microphone on for this one. I don't want this recorded. But that's why you'll see a lot of guys in OA or in AA and gals in AA. They come in here, they run out screaming. They run out of here screaming. Like, what? I thought it was the same. And the credits aren't transferable. The credits don't transfer. So you have a lot of them. It's a quarter to. I know better. I'm not doing it.